Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Matt Levine.
And Vincent Hannum.
And we're talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. Vincent, how are you doing?
I'm all right. Feeling good, feeling loose tonight. I have a baby coming. a live human child of my and my partner's DNA.
Spoken like a true monster movie lover.
I know, right? In like 2.5 weeks now at this point. So yeah, just tying up a bunch of loose ends in my life and at work, and just getting the house ready for life.
Congratulations again to you and your wife. You are going to be great parents. I can't think of two other people in my life that I think would be better parents than you. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's going to be cool to see from a distance. Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you. That means a lot. How are you?
Good. Yeah, you know, in my professional life, things are a little bit uncertain right now, but I'm looking at this as an opportunity to work on my writing and promote it as much as possible. I'm hoping to grow my Substack a little bit. So some shameless self-promotion, that Substack is matthewcolelevine.substack.com. Really hoping to keep that populated with reviews and essays and some fiction stuff as much as possible. And yeah, just trying to get more writing out there, work on novels, work on short stories, and you know, that's what I love to do. So time to embrace it. That's what I say.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I am subscribed to your Substack. I highly recommend for cinephiles and movie lovers out there, monster movies, but also everything else that's worth writing about. Matt does a great job with that. But I feel you, man. I am, you know, this is our last brand new episode of Camp Kaiju for a while. Talk more about our hiatus in a little bit, but I'm also, it's bittersweet, and the sweet part for me is that opportunity to do some more writing, so I'm looking forward to that
for sure. That's you know, it's it is bittersweet, but that's sweet for me too, just to know that you're gonna have more writing out there and like more time, you know. Comparatively speaking, I know a baby will take up a lot of that time, but yeah, just the thought of like new work from Vincent Hannum is very exciting to me. So it's, you know, it'll be cool to see what happens over the next couple months or whatever with our,
we're like, the Beatles when they broke up and they made their solo albums. That's what we're going to do now.
Okay. I mean, I don't think any of the Beatles solo work was as good as their group stuff. So I don't know. We should throw that out there, but it's good. It is good to like kind of, you know, create your own work at the same time and kind of branch out in that way. So I hear you. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, change is afoot here at Camp Kaiju. I feel like now actually might be a good time to talk about our hiatus, if that is okay with you.
Yeah, sure. So with the hiatus and our listeners out there, thank you. It's been 3 years nearly since I started Camp Kaiju, and our earlier episodes, you know, fans will know they're 5-minute reviews from me. That was our season one. Our season two, Matt came on board. Matt LeSpleen Levine, if you remember. Season two was great. I think we found we were like trying to find our groove a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then this past year, I think we definitely nailed down a successful formula. So season four next year, I'm saying it's like the icing on top of this cake. So we won't have like brand new episodes, but I will be releasing previously exclusive Patreon content. So these are going to be anywhere from 30 minutes to even 2 hours in length. We have content related to previous episodes, but even more. So more Jaws the Revenge with Sam Landman, one of our most successful and popular episodes. We have more Mothra and Mothra versus Godzilla with Ben Cook Feltz. More Frankenstein Conquers the World with our Frankenstein Minute friends. More Lovecraft with Max Hannum, who featured on our glorious episode, Valley of Guanji, and our Frozen with Fear limited series from last winter. Our general audience will be able to hear those episodes finally, once and for all. They're out of the vault. So that's a full episode on Alien versus Predator from 2004. The Thing from 1982, The Thing remake / sequel from 2011, and a movie called Cold Skin from just a few years ago. It's a pretty good Lovecraftian water humanoid creature feature. The Howling is our like send-off for season three, but until Matt and I are back, enjoy extra fun content through the first like 6 months of this coming year.
Man, that sounds great. I have a lot to say, a lot of thoughts, a lot of feelings, as one might say. First of all, thank you for bringing me on board Camp Kaiju. You know, when you first asked me a couple of years ago, I was like, this sounds so fun. This is an honor. And like it, you know, it's been even more fun and more kind of like insightful and more of a thrill than I even thought it would be. So thank you. It's been great. And you know, although this is a hiatus, it's not to say that we'll never be back or anything. So who knows? Well, you know, that certainly might happen in the future. So I don't want to make it sound like a farewell or anything like that. But
right.
But yeah, the second thing, you know, the unreleased content that you were talking about is going to be available on our website, campkaijumoviereviews.com. And we're still hoping to post on there at least every once in a while over the next 6 months or however long the hiatus lasts. So make sure to check back there often. I'm excited because I'm working on an article that's going to be about the 50 best monster movies of the 21st century. There have been so many good ones right off the bat, like The Descent, Dog Soldiers are two that come to mind right away. So that article will be coming out soon. I know, Vincent, you'll be writing some stuff for the website as well. So, you know, if you're out there and you're pining for some Camp Kaiju content, make sure to check out the website.
100%. The website and the Instagram @_kaiju. And truly, once more, big thank you from the bottom of our hearts to our patrons, Peggy, Kelly, Jason, our anonymous donor, our brand new donor. Sorry that this is news coming to you, but we hope you enjoy The Howling, because I know this movie has a lot of love and we can't wait to talk about it.
Indeed. That seems like a perfect segue to me. let's dig into The Howling. Really excited to talk about this movie. I'll try to, you know, reserve my big reveal until the end, although I'm sure it'll come out anyway before then. But let me ask you first, Vincent, what's your personal history with this movie?
I saw this movie with much anticipation in 2019, I want to say. So late to the game in my life coming to it. I'm a big werewolf movie fan. The Wolfman and An American Werewolf in London are like yearly watches for me. Love those movies. But growing up, I was aware of The Howling and I was scared of it because it, to me, it looked like a legitimately scary horror movie. So I was always a little shy to find it. But a few years ago, I was like, you know, I'm an adult now. I want to watch some other werewolf movies. I hear this is a classic. So I watched it. Of course, I loved it. And that was just a few years ago. So I saw it again for the second time just last week for this episode.
Cool. I had a pretty similar history with this movie. I first saw it pretty recently as well, I think 2 years ago. I had wanted to see it for a long time. I love Joe Dante, the director of the film. I also love werewolf movies, although there are some bad ones out there for sure, and a small number of really great ones. And yeah, I mean, you know, I guess I'll kind of tip my hat pretty early on here. This is my favorite werewolf movie, and I love it. I think it's great. So yeah, I'm excited to talk about it.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, and I'd love to compare and contrast it to some of its contemporaries in the genre. All right.
Because there were a lot. I mean, in 1981 alone, there were two other werewolf movies that came out right around the same time. So, you know, I mean, I guess I can't think of too many others except for that in the early 80s. But well, yeah, we'll talk more about that later.
Okay, great.
Cool. Should we dive into a plot synopsis?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So in The Howling, Karen White is a Los Angeles news anchor being stalked by a serial killer named Eddie Quist. She takes part in a scheme to capture Eddie by agreeing to meet him in a sleazy porn theater. Eddie forces Karen to watch a snuff film, and when Karen turns around to see Eddie, she screams. The police enter and shoot Eddie, and although Karen is safe, she suffers from amnesia. Her therapist, Doc George Wagner, decides to send her and her husband, Bill Neal, to the colony, a secluded resort in the countryside.
The colony is filled with strange characters, and one, a nymphomaniac named Marcia, tries to seduce Bill. After resisting her sexual overtures, he is attacked by a werewolf while returning to his cabin. After the attack, Karen summons her friend, a news producer named Terry Fisher, to the colony. Terry connects the resort to Eddie through a sketch he left behind, having previously discovered that Eddie's body disappeared from the morgue. Later that night, Bill meets Marcia at a campfire in the woods. While having sex in the moonlight, they transform into werewolves.
While investigating the next morning, Terry is attacked by a werewolf in a cabin, though she escapes after cutting the monster's hand off with an axe. She runs to Doc's office and calls her boyfriend, Chris Halloran, who is also a news producer. While on the phone with Chris, she is attacked by Eddie in werewolf form. Chris hears this on the other end of the line and sets off for the colony armed with silver bullets.
Karen is confronted by the resurrected Eddie Quist again, and Eddie transforms into a werewolf in front of her. Karen escapes after splashing Eddie in the face with corrosive acid. Later, as Chris arrives at the colony, he is confronted by the horribly disfigured Eddie. But that's not all. It turns out everyone in the colony is a werewolf and can shapeshift at will. As Karen and Chris escape the colony, one werewolf breaks into their car and bites Karen before being shot by Chris.
Karen resolves to warn the entire world about the existence of werewolves and begins a special international broadcast. On the air, she begins transforming into a werewolf. But will the television viewers throughout the world heed her warning before it's too late?
Nice to hide the spoiler there at the end.
Yeah, you know, we give away some spoilers, but I think, you know, we try to hide some as well. So not all the surprise of the movie is lost if people want to watch it.
Yeah. And I think this is one, I guess, our own spoiler alert. People should seek out
this movie.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, on that note, it's such a good story. It's very entertaining. It is very creepy, I think. But it also has something to say. We'll talk about that more in the theme section. But this is just a really smart screenplay, a very clever film. And yeah, can't do monster movies much better than this.
Well, what I like about it as a story is that it's not just your traditional sort of gothic type of werewolf story. It has elements of crime. It has some surprises, such as the shape-shifting, which was a pleasant surprise for me. I was like, oh, okay. So that's new. That's different from like the traditional lore of maybe Universal's The Wolfman. But Dante's The Howling still retains some of that traditional lore, such as the silver bullets. Which I love because I'm a traditionalist at heart, and I appreciate that nod to traditional werewolf mythology.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that's why we like genres, you and me in particular, why we like genres in general. Like, you do have that formula, which is very satisfying and kind of comforting in a way, but you can do really fascinating things by like pretending that you're going in a certain direction with those tropes and then really going, totally off course and like surprising the audience. And I think this movie does that very well.
Right, exactly.
So yeah, before we talk about some of the fresh ways that this movie approaches the werewolf subgenre, let's talk about the cast and crew a little bit.
I love Joe Dante. Great horror director who often mixed campy style, more in line with B movies from the 50s with clever social commentary. Three of his biggest movies are The Howling, but also Piranha from 1978, which we've covered on the podcast, and Gremlins from 1984, which I would still love to get to one day. A Christmas classic.
Yes,
He
indeed.
also directed a segment in the Twilight Zone, the movie from the 80s. So yeah, 80s was like peak Joe Dante. Highly, he was well regarded by Spielberg among many others, Scorsese, Bogdanovich. But like them, and not Spielberg, I'm getting my wires crossed a little bit. Dante got his start with Roger Corman, the director and producer and artistic, like the head producer of New World Pictures or the founder of New World Pictures.
Yeah, founder and executive producer, yeah.
So Corman, just to like, he's another guy we just got to talk about because I love Roger Corman. Monster movie lovers in general should love Roger Corman. He's still alive. He's like 100 years old. But he got his start directing B movies in the 50s, marketed to teen audiences, like with American International Pictures. But then, so all this was like outside of the main studio system. He has hundreds of movies to his credit as a director and a producer and a writer. And, the biggest thing he's like known for today is during that time of the 60s, he gave a like the first start to many of those directors, Scorsese, Bogdanovich, Coppola, who obviously have gone on to their own acclaim. Ron Howard, too. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So Roger Corman's great. And Dante was one of those directors who came from his school of movie making. So to go back to Piranha, that was Dante's first hit. It was a it's a Jaws ripoff, but I think it's so much more than that. And again, like The Howling, like sticks within the formula, but does its own thing in a way that makes you keep coming back to the movie. It's not just a cookie cutter, shark type movie. Some of Dante's later movies, oh, Matinee, The Burbs, Gremlins 2, and Small Soldiers. I always forget he directed Small Soldiers. That was a childhood favorite of mine.
Mine too. That's a great movie. It was kind of poorly reviewed when it first came out, but I think it's really smart. It's very like anti-military. And of course, like, the title or Small Soldiers are how that commentary is expressed. For any fans that don't really know Small Soldiers all that well, I would recommend checking out Jonathan Rosenbaum's review of that movie. Rosenbaum is a big Joe Dante fan, and he has a glowing review of that film when like a lot of other critics gave it like a pretty negative review. So definitely check out the movie, but also check out Rosenbaum's review if you have not read that.
Okay, will do. And how about the screenplay by John Sayles and Terrence H. Winkless?
Winkless, yeah, which is a great name. It was really mostly John Sayles' work. He largely rewrote Terrence Winkless's first draft of the screenplay. So Winkless still got credit, but this is mostly Sayles' screenplay. John Sayles had also gotten his start at New World Pictures with Roger Corman and all the directors that we just mentioned. He worked very closely with Joe Dante. He wrote Piranha, John Sayles did, for example. So with The Howling, Dante asked John Sayles to come back and rewrite Terrence Winkless's script. I should mention that Sayles also wrote the 1980 movie Alligator, another kind of classic monster movie from around this time. So yeah, he's, John Sayles just as much as Joe Dante, I think, loves monster movies, like B movies, camp, like 50s kind of matinee fare. But he really makes it his own. He adds kind of like a clever self-reflexive spin to it. He would go on to become a really acclaimed independent filmmaker in his own right. He directed such films as The Return of the Secaucus Seven, Eight Men Out, The Brother from Another Planet, Lone Star, a lot of really great movies that John Sayles wrote and directed throughout his career. And he started with these monster movies with Joe Dante. So auspicious beginnings.
Yeah. And just quick shout out for The Brother from Another Planet. I fell in love with that movie when I first saw it just this past year and think it's required viewing for science fiction fans.
Totally agree. That's my favorite Sayles movie. It's really fantastic. It's super low budget sci-fi from the early 80s, from 1984, with a great lead performance by Joe Morton.
Fantastic.
Yeah, really, really great movie.
Mm-hmm.
So Winkless, you know, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No.
Even though Winkless's work was revised, shall we say, a lot for the screenplay to The Howling, he does have a pretty interesting filmography. He wrote a lot of genre pictures like Blood Fist, Not of This Earth, and White Wolves 2, Legend of the Wild. So I don't really know most of his screenplays or his movies all that well, but I am intrigued and want to find out more.
Yeah.
The screenplay was very loosely based on the novel by Gary Brandner, but the script for the film has very little to do with the novel, in which the main character of Karen is a housewife, not a news anchor. So yeah, I mean, it's an adaptation in name only, but very, very different from the book. I put this in there. I think it's kind of interesting. So the movie was produced by Michael Fennell, who produced most of Joe Dante's movies, and also the classic comedy Airplane, which is another one of my favorites. So, you know, shout out to Michael Fennell for producing maybe the funniest movie of all time. It has really gorgeous cinematography by John Hora, who, again, worked with Dante very often. He shot both Gremlins movies as well as Matinee. In addition, he shot the Michael Jackson movie Moonwalker, which is a fun movie. Highly recommended if you haven't seen that. And John Hora was also an actor in movies like Innerspace and Honey, I Blew Up the Kids.
There you go.
So the music is by Pino Donaggio, who worked very often with Brian De Palma. Pino Donaggio scored such films as Carrie, Dressed to Kill, Blowout, and Body Double. So most of De Palma's great early filmography. It's kind of like Ennio Morricone, like, you know, like B-level Ennio Morricone, but still really like atmospheric, evocative music. The Howling was edited by Mark Goldblatt, who is an assistant on one of Hitchcock's last movies, Family Plot. And I do think there's kind of like a Hitchcockian vibe in The Howling, so maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think that influence can definitely be felt. Goldblatt was also an editor or a second unit director on such movies as Piranha, The Terminator, Terminator 2 Judgment Day, Rambo First Blood Part 2, Predator 2, Super Mario Brothers, The Last Boy Scout, Universal Soldier, True Lies, Showgirls, The Rock. I mean, this guy seemingly had a hand in like every entertaining, ridiculous action movie in the 1990s. Amazing.
Wow. Just like, good for you to get that reputation where you're the guy they want editing your action movie.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. Good work if you can get it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Way to go, Mark Goldblatt. Way to go, Goldblatt.
Yeah.
That's our motto. Anyway, sorry. That was kind of a tangent, but the last thing I'll mention with the crew, and one of the more important things probably, the special makeup effects by Rob Botten. He filled in after Rick Baker left The Howling to work on An American Werewolf in London, which also came out in 1981. Two movies that are very well known for their, you know, updated, grisly, gory werewolf of transformation effects.
Mm-hmm.
Botten had a very long, you know, illustrious career. He did the special effects for The Fog and The Thing by John Carpenter, RoboCop and Total Recall by Paul Verhoeven, and Seven and Fight Club by David Fincher. So not really an exaggeration to say that Rob Botten is one of the best special effects designers, special makeup effects, I should say, over the last 40 years or so.
Yeah, I had no idea. I mean, I know the Rick Bakers. I know Stan Winston. There's another. Oh, the guy who did the effects for King Kong 1976.
Oh, what is that guy's name?
An Italian.
Yeah. Carlo something?
Yeah, Rumbaldi? No.
Yeah, I think that's it,
is it?
Actually. Yeah.
Okay, yes. And nice. Now Botton. I just love like the lesser known names, but arguably the names that literally bring these monsters to life.
Yeah.
Should be as well known as the director or the writer. So cool. I'm happy I learned about Rob Botton.
Yeah, he's the man.
In the cast, we have Dee Williams as Karen. I knew she looked familiar. And sure enough, she has her big role in E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which came out the year after The Howling. She also starred in The Hills Have Eyes, Cujo, which is another one I've known her from, Critters and the Frighteners. Christopher Stone plays her husband, Bill. They were married in real life and appeared together again in Cujo. Interesting. I'm just like learning this as I go along. Patrick Macnee as Doc. His most famous role was as John Steed in the original The Avengers TV series. He's acted in many other TV series such as Columbo, The Twilight Zone, Magnum P.I., Murder, She Wrote, all classics of television. Dennis Dugan is Chris. He's acted in many movies. He's also directed such maybe more questionable films such as Problem Child, Happy Gilmore, Beverly Hills Ninja, Big Daddy, Jack and Jill. Okay, so he's an Adam Sandler guy.
Yeah.
Nice. Supporting performances by such classic Hollywood actors as Kevin McCarthy, who was in Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1956, John Carradine, hundreds of films, including work with John Ford and some horror highlights. I'd agree with this, Matt. House of Frankenstein and House of Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
We had Slim Pickens, many classic Westerns like Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and One-Eyed Jax and Dr. Strangelove. And the one and only Dick Miller, who acted in all of Dante's films. Dick Miller also was a Roger Corman regular. He was in the first Little Shop of Horrors, a non-musical version of that movie from 1961. That was directed by Roger Corman. Other movies include Chopping Mall, Night of the Creeps, The Terminator, A Bucket of Blood, and Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight, which is apparently fucking awesome. Quote Matt Levine.
I had to throw that in there because I just watched Demon Knight like 2 weeks ago, and it is awesome. Like, it is a really fun horror movie. I cannot recommend that movie any higher if you haven't seen it. Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight. So good.
Cool.
So
Yeah, I mean, what a glowing review. Just real quick, I've been watching, I've started Roger Corman's Poe cycle. Have you seen those movies?
I've seen three or four of them, yeah.
Yeah, those are fascinating nuggets of film. I'm obsessed with them right now.
Yeah, they're really interesting for sure. I think the quality kind of varies a lot, you know, some of them are not as successful as other ones. And sometimes I just want them to be a little bit like campier and more ridiculous than they actually are.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, they look really good. There are some like very memorable moments. So yeah, they're worth watching for sure.
Yeah. Oh, what a can of worms we've opened, but we'll close. Because it's Howling Night here at Camp Kaiju.
It's just hard to resist these cool like interconnections, you know? Like,
oh,
some
yeah.
Favorite movies and like, you know, artists, film artists are like involved with this movie. It's great.
Yeah, and this is where we get to nerd out, because like a lot of these movies I haven't seen, but I know the titles because the titles are so good. Chopping Mall, are you kidding me? It's a brilliant title.
Chopping Mall is a really great movie. I watched that maybe 2 years ago. It's so much fun. As good as that name implies. It's
great. Yeah. Amazing. It's on my list. It's on my like on Tubi. I have a list of movies I've curated for myself, so I'll get to it eventually.
You're gonna love it. I can't wait to hear
it. Can't wait.
Yeah, so again, a lot of talent involved with this movie. Like we mentioned, it was produced by Roger Corman's New World Pictures. Joe Dante brought on John Sayles because he wanted kind of a more self-aware satirical tone than Terrence Winkless's original draft of the screenplay. According to Dante, at the time that the movie came out, or I think this was actually a later interview when he was talking about The Howling. He said that at the time he made it, werewolves were kind of considered corny and old hat, maybe a little bit like old school Universal monster movie that, like, you know, isn't fresh anymore, was maybe like the general opinion that people had. So Dante's approach was to disguise The Howling for as long as possible and make it look like a slasher film, which was a lot more popular at the time in the early 80s, and then slowly bring in the supernatural element so that the audience could get acclimated and not immediately rejected as something old-fashioned. That's a direct quote from Dante. And I think it works so well. Like, the first 20 minutes of this movie feels like a, you know, kind of a sex thriller in like a Brian De Palma vein. And it's really stylish, really creepy, unexpected. It's a wonderful way to start this movie, if a little bit disturbing at times.
Right. And that's that kind of maybe blend of genre that I latch onto this film. And I totally get what Dante's talking about, because you talk about werewolves, you talk about vampires, you talk about mummies. Like, these things aren't scary anymore. I'm sure they were scary at one point, obviously. But like, how do you reinvent that successfully? Mm-hmm. And I think The Howling does that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's fine to mention this now. Like, The Howling did pretty well commercially and kind of led to a trend throughout the 80s of doing exactly that, of like reimagining these classic Universal monsters in movies like Cat People, which, you know, was an RKO, not a Universal movie, but still kind of a similar thing. Mm-hmm. And then updating like vampire lore in movies like The Lost Boys and Near Dark and movies like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, arguably The Howling and also An American Werewolf in London kind of started off that trend a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Good point.
Yeah, so in addition to An American Werewolf in London, which we already talked about, there was also Wolfen, which came out in between these two movies. All three of them came out like within 4 months of each other, I think. I've never seen Wolfen. I'm pretty interested by it.
Same.
I don't think it's supposed to be all that great, but, you know, we've seen two of the three werewolf movies from 1981. I feel like we have to see the third one.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring up this question. Maybe it's a question for our listeners out there, if you want to send us an email or reply on social media. But we already talked a little bit about Rob Bottin did the makeup effects for The Howling, and Rick Baker did the special makeup effects for An American Werewolf in London. Both kind of legendary horror movies that updated, you know, gruesome werewolf transformations. So which movie has the better special effects? It's hard to say. They're both fantastic, really gory and like, you know, visceral. I know I overuse that word a lot, but so let us know if you think that like The Howling is the best werewolf effects of all time, or An American Werewolf in London. Yeah, we want to answer this once and for all.
You know, they both make use of animatronics. I'm talking about the transformation itself, because mm-hmm. I think you have the transformation from man into wolf, and then you for special effects, and then you have the wolf itself for special effects. And the wolves themselves are different, because An American Werewolf in London is very much a four-legged wolf type creature, whereas in The Howling, it's a two-legged, more wolfman type creature. Both great in their own respective ways. But for the transformation, I noted both used animatronics in the face to like create the snout coming out of the skull, ears growing out of the head. I think it comes down, I don't know. I feel like the camera lingers more on the full body transformation in An American Werewolf in London, where you can see just more of the body itself. I don't know. I'm a little biased too, because I can quote that movie incessantly. But but what do you think, Matt?
It's close. You know, I mean, I think they're both great in different ways, like you were talking about. For me, I mean, I think I have to give the edge to The Howling a little bit. Like, the effects are really great, of course, but I think also like the way that that scene is introduced, which I would like to talk about a little bit later in like the good section, because there's one scene in The Howling that is like one of the best jump scares that just like comes out of nowhere and then like gets scarier and like nastier from there. So like the context surrounding the actual transformation scene is better in The Howling, in my opinion. So that leads me to kind of give the edge to this movie a little bit.
Okay, so we have a split decision here on Camp Kaiju. Audience, fans, please write in. Let us know. Break this tie.
So we can, yeah, finish this debate once and for all with a definitive answer.
And then Wolfen fans are in the corner like, no, we have the best transformation.
It's very possible. We won't know until we see Wolfen also. So let's move to the top of our list. In any case, The Howling was a pretty big success. It grossed almost $18 million on a $1.5 million budget. The popularity of this film led to Dante being hired to direct Gremlins. The offer was made to him, I think, while this movie was in post-production. It was not only a fun movie, but an influential movie in its own way.
And it led to a whole series of Howling movies. We have The Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf, Howling 3, Howling 4, The Original Nightmare, Howling 5, The Rebirth, Howling 6, The Freaks, Howling, New Moon Rising, and then the last one came out in 2011, The Howling Reborn.
I have not seen any of those, have you?
Nope.
All right, this is another series that we have to tackle at some point. Maybe on the website, maybe on the podcast, who knows? But I'm excited to watch them. It sounds fun.
Yo, if there's strong enough demand, I will write a retrospective of the Howling series. I can do a ranking deep dive, but I don't know about that unless there's like true demand for it. So
yeah,
Howling fans, let us know.
I would read that. I would read the hell out of that article. So. You will have other priorities on your plate, so who knows if that'll happen, but regardless, I definitely want to watch all those Howling movies. It's so cool. I like, in addition to the movies, I think the novelist Gary Brandner, is that his name, wrote I think two other Howling novels after his first Howling novel, so this became like a big franchise, you know.
Wow. Yeah,
and I think the novels had nothing to do with the movies, but
naturally, kind of cool.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say about that is if you do a deep dive into the Howling movies and like rank them or whatever you want to do, I would do the same thing for the Phantasm movies, which I still want to watch. And there
How
are
many
like
of those are there?
There are, I think, 5 or 6 sequels.
There are a total of 5 movies.
Oh, that's fewer than I thought. Okay.
But that's still a decent number. I think if you have more than 3, that you're doing something popular.
Yeah, that's a series, you know?
Yeah, solid series.
All right, well, maybe that will happen. The Howling and Phantasm on the website. We'll see.
Yeah.
Now is probably a good time for our sponsor break. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. All right, so we mentioned that The Howling, you know, is more than kind of just a straightforward monster movie. It has some kind of clever things to say. Do you want to talk about any of the themes in the movie?
Yeah, totally. I caught on to the beast inside of us. And this culture of violence that seems to permeate the world in which this movie exists. Mm-hmm. We've talked about, you know, 1980s America, late 1970s, you know, there's a strain of violence reflected in some mainstream movies, but in The Howling, it's definitely personified in not just the werewolves, but a character like Eddie Quist, who is a serial killer. Who is also a werewolf. So what does this mean, civilization versus savagery?
Going off of what you were saying, you know, I think that's kind of the underlying theme of most werewolf movies, like The Beast Inside of Us, and like, is it better or worse to like repress our animal urges or to pretend that we're civilized humans living in a, you know, a civil modern society? And that's, I think, conveyed really cleverly by the colony in this movie, which is sort of like Like, it's basically a cult. It's kind of a self-help group where it starts off with kind of, you know, psychiatric sort of like platitudes about, oh, like, you know, like no repression. It can only be harmful to like repress the beast inside of you. But then, of course, like not repressing the beast inside of you leads to violence and murder and like all kinds of like mayhem and gruesomeness. So, yeah, it's just kind of a clever update of that theme, because repression is not a great thing, but the alternative to that, like, clearly is not an ideal alternative. So, you know, in a way, it's maybe kind of like a cynical conclusion, because you're screwed either way. If you like repress your animal urges, you're just going to kind of like, they're just going to fester inside of you and like build up and maybe need to be unleashed in some way. But then when you unleash them, something like the howling is going to happen. So, yeah, it's a clever update on that theme, I think.
Yeah, and I think paralleled with that is a theme of sexuality in the film. Are humans better off when they indulge their carnal desires? The subtext, you know, is also very common in werewolf movies. In fact, I think it's just inherent to this genre. Mm-hmm. There's a part of the first time you meet the colony, you know, it's just a seemingly innocent beach party. And there's an old man, and he's just kind of sitting alone, and he's watching younger people around him, sort of just reveling in sexual delight. And he can no longer do that. And he throws him, doesn't he try to throw himself into a fire? And they stop him.
And then, Doc stops him at the last moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they kind of throw it off as just like, oh, what a wacky guy. Don't pay any attention to him. But yeah, he's dealing with some serious, psychiatric issues, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure the sexual frustration is there, but also for me, I just saw it as like, he's a man at the end of his life. He's a freaking werewolf. He's just like got a lot of demons that he's battling. And yeah, it was a really poignant moment.
I thought so too. It's almost like mentally he doesn't have those inhibitions anymore, but physically, like, his body sort of just can't stand it at that point, you know, mm-hmm. which would be really hard to deal with.
Mm-hmm. The colony, you know, we're talking about it, it's a cult, but it's also a pack in a way, mm-hmm. because everyone in the colony is a werewolf, and you see these power dynamics, especially with the men and the women. And the women in this film struck me as something worth talking about, because Karen, she's a TV news reporter before she visits the colony. Like, she's an independent woman with this career. And when she goes to the colony, she's not the only woman there, but she falls into this subservient role almost with all the other men and her husband, Bill. Like, he backhands her in the face at one point out of anger, and they had like a loving relationship before, but then they come to the colony and suddenly she's abused emotionally, physically, and I'm just like, oh, this is interesting. And then the other woman, Marsha, she's a nymphomaniac, and she's very independent, very strong in her sexual desires, so I don't want to take that away from her, but her character is just all about sex. So again, like, in a male dominated film, what role do these women, you know, what messages does the role of women in this film have to say?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I think, you know, I think Karen, even before she goes to the colony, is dealing with so much misogyny around her all the time. Like, the executive producer at the news station, like, it, definitely after her attack happens, when Eddie attacks her in the porn theater, you know, he's like, oh, she's not going to be able to handle this. Maybe she's pregnant. She's like, let's get a man out there. Like, he's a really despicable character for sure. And then we have Doc, her therapist, who is the one who kind of starts all this in motion in the first place, who, you know, comes up with the idea for Karen and her husband to go to the colony. So he seems to be kind of like the mastermind behind all of this, you know. And then we get to the actual scene where she's in the porn theater and she's watching a snuff film. Really, you know, it's a disturbing scene for sure. It is very stylish and creepy. And it's kind of likened to her role in the mass media a little bit. You know, she's on camera all the time. There are all these close-ups in the movie of like camera lenses sort of just like staring at her very menacingly. And in one shot, she even kind of like sees like an image of a werewolf, like in the lens of the camera. So I just think the ways that this movie combines all these different forms of misogyny in the mass media, in the therapeutic industry, from her own husband, you know, it's very like clear that the movie's trying to get this across, and it has a lot of sympathy for Karen's character, I think.
Totally. It's not a movie that uplifts the themes of misogyny, but it's definitely is a critique of it. Yeah, Karen's a tragic figure. Especially by the end of the movie, you're just like, damn it.
Yeah. Devastating ending. It is shocking to me, so I don't want to give it away if we can avoid it, but it's, I mean, you feel for her, for sure. If giving into like your base animal urges leads to abuse and like leads to Bill kind of like, you know, physically and emotionally abusing his wife, obviously like giving into like your animal impulses is not a totally healthy thing. I think it's all kind of connected in that way too, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about her role as a news anchor. Just the critique of the news and its intersection with popular media makes me think about Network from a few years prior to this film, which had similar critiques of the industry. And like they literally use Karen as bait for a sensational, you know, we're going to capture Eddie Quist. And it's like, at what point is that too far? You're endangering her life for a headline.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Even like her friends that work at the news station, it's like, well, you know, where are you guys? Where are the friends that are supposed to be like protecting her from this, you know?
Right.
They're complicit in it too. So this movie is really funny and entertaining, but I think ultimately it is pretty cynical because Karen doesn't have many people to support her. And, you know, I think it's like a great, very cynical, dark joke at the end that she stages this really shocking transformation on camera for like all the world to see. And the movie cuts to all these different people watching it and they're like, oh, it's fake. Oh, it's a special effects. Like, yeah, I mean, this movie kind of thinks that people have just been desensitized to shocking, violent images on TV. And it's, you know, I mean, I think that realization has only become more apparent over the last 40 years.
Well, not to get too into this, but how about when all the UFO stuff in our real world was dropping just this past year? Mm-hmm. Like huge exposés and like the government finally saying, yeah, these are UFOs. We have no idea. Here's the footage. And I talked to a lot of people who just kind of shrugged like, yeah, well, if they're real, so what? Like aliens are like the least of our worry right now. And it's just like, no, this should be huge, shocking truth. But people are desensitized to even the thought of extraterrestrials now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. And that's not even to talk about images of like war and like real world violence that now are just like, oh, it's more war. Yeah.
Right.
Like I feel like a lot of people just are not affected by that anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And The Howling comments on that a little bit.
I agree. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
I didn't think about the connection to Network, but that's a good comparison.
It's totally true. I love Network.
Yeah, yeah. Peter Finch, right?
He's so William good, Holden and
Faye Dunaway.
Faye Dunaway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gives me chills.
Yes, yeah. Another very cynical movie.
Extremely cynical.
it was in vogue at that time, in the late 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Understanding. but as mentioned, this is like a very fun, exciting, you know, creepy, scary movie. And that's reflected by the form of the film. I think it's so well shot. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous movie, like a colorful widescreen cinematography with like really stark lighting. And I was interested that that's true in both like the urban and the rural spaces of the film. Like towards the beginning, when they're in the big city, there are all these shots when she's in the porn theater and there are all these like dazzling lights and like, you know, like screens everywhere. And it looks very, like the threat is all around her, basically. But then when she goes to the colony, things don't really get that much better. And there are all these really creepy shots of like light filtering through the woods, some of which look really surreal in the best kind of like nightmarish way. So yeah, the cinematography in this movie, again by John Hora, is just really fantastic. It's so well shot.
Yeah, great use of light in the urban and the rural landscapes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I, you know, like The Fog came out around the same time by John Carpenter in 1980, I think. And I think The Fog and The Howling are like the two most beautiful horror movies ever made. Just stunningly gorgeous. I love them.
Wow. I'm not disagreeing. I just need to, yeah, that's just, I did notice the cinematography and The Howling and the atmospheric tone that it just set, especially in the woods. Like great use of fog and again light, but also in the cityscape. Like, yeah, I'm just repeating what you said at this point, but yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's so well shot. Was there anything else about the form or the aesthetic that you wanted to mention at all?
I love the music. I love the use of pipe organs in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it reminded me of a more traditional gothic type werewolf movie. And I think that's just Joe Dante being such a smart student of the genre, where he knows, okay, this is like a slasher 80s movie, but when we're in the woods and the moonlight is filtering through the fog, let's hit it with some pipe organs. Let's give that subconscious feel that we're in a 1930s black and white movie all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I love that kind of stuff.
Totally agree. Yeah. I think, you know, like there's the kind of pipe organy music that like builds suspense and dread in moments like that. And then like in these other moments where like something shocking is happening on screen, there's this great sort of like, you know, heavy strings crescendo, which is very similar to like what Bernard Herrmann did in so many Alfred Hitchcock movies. And it's great. I mean, it works so well here. Both, you know, there are two different kind of like strains of music and they're both really effective.
Yeah. There's other parts, and this is like my good stuff too, but, you know, I love Dante's little nods to film history. I think at one point, I think it's Karen and Bill or their friends. They're in bed watching The Wolfman from 1941. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh yeah, that's perfect. That's tongue in cheek. That's Joe Dante's humor coming through. There's also, I think, a Looney Tune or something with the big bad wolf playing on the TV. So, you know, just for movie lovers, you just love that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And some other references in there too, like an Allen Ginsberg book with the poem Howl kind of like front and center towards the camera. Yeah. I mean, Joe Dante does a lot of those kind of like, not just cinematic references, but like literary references and like in jokes and stuff like that. Like a reference to Piranha is in this movie as well.
Oh, I missed that one.
I can talk about that in the campy section maybe. Okay. But yeah, it's charming. I love it when he does stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's probably time to move on to the good in that case. Is there anything else that you want to talk about for the good category?
I love the concept of the colony. It's kind of a twist. It's not a big twist, but the fact that you're not dealing with just one werewolf in this movie, but it turns out that everybody's a werewolf. The first time I watched this, I did a double take, you know, metaphorically. I was like, oh, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
This is awesome. Because you think you're led to believe it's Eddie, right? He's the serial killer. He's going to be the werewolf. But no, Karen's in deep shit because she's surrounded by werewolves at this point.
Yeah, all hell really breaks loose towards the end. And, you know, I think since it's kind of like a cult, like, you know, self-help group type thing, I think there's definitely like a critique of mob mentality there a little bit too, you know?
Oh, yeah. And you talk about all hell breaking loose. That whole end sequence, the escape from the barn, just phenomenal action sequencing. It's just it just builds on itself. You know, you have the friends showing up, you got the standoff with the silver bullets, and then the barn is set alight and the wolves are inside trying to break out. then there's a car chase, and then there's a wolf on top of the car, and you're just like, oh my God, get out of here.
Yeah, it's kind of unrelenting at towards the end in like the best possible way.
Yeah, riveting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally agree. I've talked about a lot of good stuff and a lot of things I love about this movie already, but I do want to talk about my favorite scene in the movie, which is when Terry, it's Terry, right? Let me double check the story here real quick. No, I'm sorry, it's Karen. So Karen is like she's in like a cabin at the colony, and she's just kind of like digging through files. It's kind of like a slow investigation scene. It's kind of taken a while. She's on the phone, I think, to Chris, the like her producer friend at the station. And just at the point when you're like, why is this taking so long? Like suddenly a werewolf hand just like reaches in from like off screen and like grabs some of the files out of her hand. And like you see it and you're like, holy shit, is that what I think it is? And then like right after that is when that transformation scene takes place. And that's why it's so effective, I think. Like there's this long buildup to it. And like the way it's first introduced is like so sudden and unexpected that it really is like a jump scare. And then like the jump scare just gets like more and more insane and like gruesome from there. Like all the best things about this movie or many of the best things, like the staging, the camera work, the like just Joe Dante's like sense of rhythm and composition, perfectly exemplified by that scene.
Yeah, that's another great scene that just builds on itself. It's pretty hard to look away from it.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though it's so disgusting at the same time.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, so many other good things about this movie too, which we've already talked about. What about the bad? Is there anything bad about this movie?
I had, you know, not qualms, right? But just like, oh, maybe for me that doesn't exactly age well, or not, maybe I wanted more of. So, you know, to go back to the ending, I love the relentless pacing of that final sequence, and I'm not going to spoil the ending, but for me it ended more abruptly than I was expecting, and just based with everything the movie was giving me up until that point, I kind of wanted more of a release, of a cathartic release. You know, so I don't know, for me, I just kind of wanted more. The ending with the hamburger was so funny that I feel like it maybe undermined all this great, like, critique and the cynicism. But then again, you can make the argument, nothing's more cynical than just like, yeah, we're going to end our movie on ground meat burning, which is like also brilliant, but I don't know if it was tonally the right choice. The animation in this movie is dated. I think it's like a really small moment when Bill turns into a werewolf at the campfire.
Yeah.
But it's low hanging fruit to criticize that, but it's there, and I'm like, it just doesn't age well when everything else is so practical.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's valid for sure. It's a very strange image when that comes up all of a sudden. So I totally agree with you there. I do love that last shot of like the meat on the griddle or whatever. Like I love it. But I understand maybe it kind of like dilutes the power of like what we've seen just before that. So I hear what you're saying there, but God, I love that last shot so much.
I know I think you either love it or you hate it, and I get why it's there, but for me it doesn't work 100%.
Yeah, I hear you. I think for me, like, the biggest issue in this movie, and it's not a huge issue, but I think like it's kind of, we don't really have like a protagonist to like root for, you know, like it's kind of hard to know if there is supposed to be a main character through which we follow the action. Like at some points it's Karen, and very briefly it's Bill. And then at other points it's Terry and Chris, the like friends at the news studio. So I just think that like dilutes the tension a little bit sometimes when there's like one scene where we're following one character, and then for like a little bit of time we follow another character, and it kind of is a leap to like, you know, to kind of just like change the character identification a little bit. This is such a minor thing, and it's like pretty much the only thing I think is like an issue with the movie. So I'm grabbing at straws here, but it does make it slightly less dramatic sometimes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all I got.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I think just generally at times there is a lack of tension for me. I mean, again, I really enjoy this movie and I'm never bored by it at all. But there's something about it that I don't know, fails to keep me 100% there. And I think I just have to rewatch it again. But again, I do like this movie a lot, despite whatever I just said. So take, you know, I don't know. Ignore whatever I just said. If you choose to do that, that's okay too.
I think, you know, the sometimes, like, because we have the good, the bad, and the campy category, like, sometimes I'm like, oh, I have to find something bad about this movie, you know? Even if, like, for the most part, I'm like, I love this movie so much, and like whatever I dislike about it is kind of irrelevant. Like, still, we kind of, you know, have to talk about the bad stuff, but maybe the bad doesn't matter, you know?
Like, we watched Wolf recently with Jack Nicholson, Mike Nichols' werewolf movie. That's a bad werewolf movie. The effects are bad. The transformation's bad. Everything's bad. It was hard to like come up with good things with that movie. The Howling is not my favorite werewolf movie, but it's still top tier. So that's all I'll say.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear you. I do want to know what your favorite werewolf movie is, but maybe you can mention that in your wrap up if you'd like.
Yes, I'll do that.
Okay. First we have to talk about the campy. Is there any campy stuff that you want to talk about first?
Dick Miller, he's this bookseller, and he has all these books on the occult and werewolf and lycanthropy, and he's just like this fountain of knowledge. And he doesn't like, he's not a, for lack of a better word, like a werewolf hunter or anything. He's just a guy who sells books, and he's apparently read all of his books. And he's like, no, silver bullets, you know, silver bullets work, but that full moon stuff, that's all myth. Your real werewolves are shapeshifters. And he's just like such a salt of the earth guy.
Yeah.
Who has his infinite knowledge of werewolves.
Yeah. It's a ridiculous scene. Like, why would he know that much about werewolves?
It's only there because we need this scene in order to get the setup and the silver bullets that's going to pay off at the end. But it's definitely a moment of camp in an otherwise serious film.
Yeah. I think that there's some campiness that's added to that scene, because when we first transitioned to that scene, there are two nuns that are like walking by his shop, and they like look at the storefront window and they like nod to each other like, yeah, we got to check this out, you know? It's such a funny, brief joke. It never, like, those nuns never come back in the movie at all, but it's very amusing.
Yep.
Part's great. And yeah, I mean, that was on my list too for like the campiest part of this movie. Gotta love Dick Miller. He's the best.
Mm-hmm.
The only extra thing that I'll mention in the campy category is when they first go into Eddie Quist's apartment, they see like all these news headlines on the wall. Like in true serial killer fashion, he's kind of this like hermit recluse that's like has all these faded news stories up on the wall. But there's one headline that says death by man eating piranhas. So obviously an allusion to Dante's own film Piranha. So yeah, again, I love that sort of thing and that kind of like winking in joke. Dante does that a lot in his movies, and this is one of the best examples, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's not distracting at all. It just, you know it if you know it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
The Howling. Man, this has been a fun conversation, but as always, it is time to give it a rating. As always on Camp Kaiju, our ratings are: number one, it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time. What do you think? Would you like me to go first or would you like to go first?
No, I'll go first because I would love you to have the final word on this film. No. Because I think it stands the test of time, but I think there are some dated moments that right, okay. Like some movies we've talked about on Camp Kaiju, this is a classic werewolf movie. This is a classic of the genre. I think it is essential viewing for werewolf fans. With that said, I have seen some of the other well-noted werewolf movies. And for me, like An American Werewolf in London is my personal favorite. I think that movie just sings on a lot of different notes, comedic and horror and tragedy, that I feel like I wanted more out of The Howling. Maybe I wanted a little more camp out of The Howling. I love that it took itself very seriously, but I think maybe to its detriment a little bit. So it's just like a feeling thing for me, but I am maybe for better or for worse comparing it to some other movies that I also enjoy. So that's where I'm at. Has some dated moments, but definitely stands the test of time.
Yeah, no, that's totally valid. I mean, it's always subjective and it's always kind of like a gut impulse thing, you know? So I totally get that. Yeah. On a similar note, I mean, this is my favorite werewolf movie, my favorite Joe Dante movie, one of my favorite horror movies ever. Really, really love this movie so much. It's a timeless classic to me. It definitely stands the test of time. I think it looks so beautiful. And at the same time, like the special effects are great. The makeup effects are great. I think the movie does have a lot to say about the usual werewolf theme of like repressing the inner beast in like a way that's kind of also brings in, you know, patriarchy and misogyny and like the desensitization to violence that mass media has kind of brought about over the last 40 or 50 years. So I think there's so much to this movie, and it's also funny and scary. One of my favorites. Love it.
Yeah, I love this movie too for those same reasons. So yeah. I'm really glad you decided to bring this to the podcast kind of at the last minute, but I think it's a perfect movie for us to talk about.
Thank you. That's good to hear. It is, you know, as you mentioned before, bittersweet that this is the last episode before our hiatus, but it's a good one to go out on, and we'll still have a lot of content on the website. So Camp Kaiju will never die.
As long as there are podcasts out there, you can listen wherever you enjoy audio media.
Exactly. Yeah. on that note, I'm getting a little choked up over here, but you know, it's a fun note to go out on, as I mentioned. So thank you all again for hanging out. If you liked what you hear, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit campkaijumoviereviews.com or Instagram for more monster movie content. We can't thank you enough. Camp Kaiju was recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with theme music by Terrence Jackson and Minya's Mailbox by Ben Cook Feltz. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio.
We'll find out if any of Eddie's killings were on a full moon.
Hey, that's a lot of Hollywood baloney. Your classic werewolf could change shape anytime it wants, day or night, whenever it takes a notion to. That's why I call them shapeshifters. I got a dozen books on it.
What about killing it with silver bullets?
Well, sure. Silver bullets are fire. It's the only way to get rid of the damn things. They're worse than cockroaches. They come back from the dead if you don't kill them right. Plus, they regenerate. You know what that is? Cut off an arm, cut off a leg, stick a knife in a heart, nothing. They may look dead, but bam, 3 days later, they're as good as new.
You believe in this?
What am I, an idiot? I'm making a buck here. You want books? I got books. I got chicken blood. I got dog embryos. I got black candles. I got wolf bane. Look at this. Silver bullets. Some joker ordered them. 3006. Never picked them up. I take Bank America, American Express, Visa. You gonna buy that or what?